Pari bajo cuete ma.
Morellanza, Morellanza.
Bien, pari bajo cuete ma.
Hi, this is John Amundsen. I want to welcome you to the next podcast in a series of podcasts presented for you by the Psychologist Association of Alberta. The purpose of the podcast is to present information, timely, topical, and even controversial to the membership. I started with this particular lead-in because it is an oración or narration to a particular god. West Africa had a animistic approach to spirituality, and they had orishas, and orishas were carriers of particular powers that would assist you in the physical world. And this one, Babaluya, I think is the way they pronounce it, Babaluyai, I don't know. Hey, it's been transferred to the West, and in Cuba and other places in the Caribbean, Brazil, they practice Santeria. I think I've talked about this in their podcast, but they practice Santeria, which is this Yoruba religion from Nigeria. And the reason this oración is important for us, it is the particular orisha, or deity, or spirit form, that has to do with healing. So healing in every possible form, any sort of infirmity. So this would be the one that we would chant and sing with our patients, or sing in the morning when we're on our way to work, so that we have that particular guy working with us and for us. Partly this is also presented because I wanted to do something on an article that was published in Psychological Trauma, Theory, Research, Practice, and Policy, examining the relations among moral foundations, potentially morally injurious events, and post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. And what they were trying to look at were two sorts of moral foundations that would either be potentially contributory to morally injurious events, and or the development of post-traumatic stress disorder. And they wanted to look at, were there particular differences in the moral foundations? And they were looking at two. Those moral foundations that pertain to individualizing, and those that pertain to binding or to a group affiliation. Individualized moral issues are things, you know, that also, I would not steal, I would not kill, I would hope to be kind, I would hope to be virtuous or helpful to others. And the binding ones have to do with affiliation with others and that sense of connection and the demands that go with that. Now, in this research, what they found was that there is a positive association between the binding moral foundation and post-traumatic stress disorder, meaning that it is less one's individual moral inclination that would lead to post-traumatic stress, but the idea of loyalty, authority, and purity. And so when people are experiencing post-PTSD, they were looking at military folks here, but let's take it for anyone. Let's take it for those agents of social control that many of us work with or have worked with. So police, firefighters, paramedics, when there is that post-traumatic stress disorder, we would understand that it probably relates more to the binding aspects of their moral foundation, loyalty, authority, and purity, than it would relate to their individual, perhaps, moral configuration. It would make sense. Because the person would feel somehow, even with this belief that being doing the right thing, or taking orders, so to speak, following protocols, being loyal to those values that are espoused by a group, and then purity. Purity is a concept that Jonathan Haidt had introduced in his attempts to differentiate liberals, progressives from conservatives. And purity means a strong commitment to the way we should all be. So this might be helpful for some of you who are working more in this area, and the idea that there is this underlying sense of the binding moral issues have failed in some way, so I'm experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. A second article that might pertain also to healing is one that was in developmental psychology, and the title of the article was Childhood Abuse and Neglect and Self-Reported Symptoms of Psychopathology Through Midlife. They were looking at a sample of 144 participants in the Minnesota Longitudinal Study of Risk and Adaptation, half female, half male, and about 70% white or Anglo. They followed through, and they were looking at the impact of abuse and neglect. And of course, as we understand, these were robustly associated with symptoms of psychopathology in adulthood. But in the analysis, when they were looking at specific, what they call parameterizations, that is, specific areas that would be associated with this, they found that abuse and neglect were not specifically potent, but abuse perpetrated by maternal figures rather than maternal figures rather than paternal or non-parental figures was uniquely associated with high levels of self-reported pathology. The subtypes of abuse and or neglect in the mixture was less significant. But again, this goes back to one of the traditions that we have had in psychology, which is mother blaming, and becomes a basis to support a little bit more of that relative specifically to abuse by maternal figures. Journal of Family Psychology had a good article as well. And for a lot of us that have spent our lives, professional lives, working with families and families in conflictual, high conflict patterns, and especially the high conflict divorce stuff and parenting, the article is Predictors of Forgiveness Among Divorced Parents. I think what they found would be pretty clear to most of us who work in this area, but the construct of forgiveness, which means, you know, get over it, I got past it, you know, it has been resolved. That the term forgiveness applies, I believe, in a sense, especially in their research to that, was it was negatively associated with conflict severity, narcissistic entitlement, hostile attributions, and the traumatic impact of the divorce. So these are mostly dynamic issues that one would become aware of in working with the couple, the parents, a couple, we'll call them a couple, but the parents. It was possibly associated with trust and acceptance of the divorce. So where one or both had not accepted the divorce, where there were hostile attributions, he, she is out to get me, where there's narcissistic entitlement, this shouldn't happen to a person like me, I should have it be a different way. And then where the actual conflict severity is high, then this idea of getting past it, forgiveness, quote, being the operative term, wasn't there. On the other hand, once there's acceptance and less of this sense of entitlement, you know, I should get and have. See, what's really funny is when you work with these families, you know, someone will say, we had one recently, and Father's Day had just passed, and the mother rolls her eyes and says to me, he just sent me an email and said, hey, it's Father's Day, I'm going to pick the kids up. See, you know, and she just said, well, yeah, he certainly should have them on Father's Day, but that sense of, this is what they would call in the article, narcissistic entitlement, but makes it an announcement, not a request or what would be convenient. How do you want to do for none of that? And so we see this in the high conflict ones where there's a sense of this is automatically the way it should be. It was unrelated, though, however, to dispositional self-control and trait anger. In other words, that even when there were individuals that by trait or predisposition have problems of self-control and strong emotion, those were not as related as the other ones, the other four that the other four things we've already spoken of. Cool, eh? Our last healing discussion has to do with an article that was in the Behavioral Neuroscience. And the title of the article is, I don't know how to pronounce this, but I think I've got it, Hesperitin Rescues Emotional Memory and Synaptic Plasticity Deficit in Aged Rats. There's the hippocampal area, of course, has to do with emotional responsiveness to circumstances. And hippocampal long-term potentiation is important because it keeps us in touch emotionally with our world. And this is a deficit that takes place, emotional memory deficit takes place with aging. So they were looking at how they might improve this using rats as the test subjects. And that aged rats exhibited impaired emotional learning and impaired long-term potentiation in the hippocampus. So they wanted to then see if there was some way to repotentiate that with the idea of using this to assist people who suffer this from Alzheimer's disease. Normal aging Alzheimer's disease do impact this emotional memory stuff. So they use this drug, Hesperitin. It's a flavonoid, and it passes through the blood-brain barrier, and it has neuroprotective effects. So they went ahead and did this, and they found that there may be a pivotal role for this drug in synaptic plasticity and associated fear memory in aged rats. That is, they kept these rats. I'm sure what they did, you know, is they put the rats through some terrible experience and then watch them age out so that all of a sudden that grid, that color, that door didn't have the same long-term potentiation. So they would say, oh, it was kind of zzz, and they get a shock again. And then after they gave them this, they go, I ain't going to that door, I'm walking on that grid, I ain't touching that color. That's what I assume they did. So, but they did find it did this. So it's a potential candidate for treating emotional memory deficit with aging. Good, eh? So that's it for today, and we'll find some song to march us out.